Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. If this were not a podcast, but a conversation in front of a live audience, and I were to ask you, the audience, if you think we live at a time of dangerously rising political and civil conflict worldwide, I bet most of you would raise your hands and say, absolutely. Yet it wasn't that long ago that scholars, never mind politicians, but scholars like Steven Pinker and Yuval Noah Harari were arguing that violence was receding globally and humanity was entering an age of peace and prosperity, something obviously we all hoped would happen. I know that caricature is a bit unfair, but it surely is directionally right, and just as surely factually wrong. On this episode of New Thinking for a New World, we're going to talk about those facts with someone who is devoting her career to understanding and documenting violent global civil conflict. Cleona Raleigh founded and leads ACLID, which stands for Armed Conflict Location and Events Data, and is a professor of political violence and geography at the University of Sussex. Welcome, Professor Raleigh, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.
Let's start with a very simple question. How much conflict is occurring in the world today?
Oh, tremendous amount. I mean, just in the space between 2022 and 2023, we saw an increase of approximately 12%. And while, of course, the conflict in Ukraine and also the more recent conflict between Israel and Gaza has increased, let's say, the event rate or the frequency rate of conflict events by about 25%, what we still have is an incredibly high rate of conflict that is reproduced year on year. But I appreciate you bringing up the previous references to Pinker, in part because there was a real sense that we had entered into a more peaceful era. But what I always found quite frustrating about that argument is that it was looking at the combination of what we might call insurgencies or civil wars or interstate wars, and assuming that that accounted for the bulk of violence, when in fact, it's very clear now that we have much better data that what most people experience is far more like a Haiti situation than a Ukraine situation. And there are far more Haiti-like situations in the world today, and we can see that they will likely increase into the future.
In addition, and this is really critical to the work you are doing, you look at the impact on people. Mm-hmm. And my sense of having looked at ACLID's data is that way more people than you would expect, than you would get from just reading the newspapers or listening to the news, a far higher percentage of people globally are impacted by violence of this kind of, whether it's called organized or disorganized, this mm-hmm. kind of conflict.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we recently started with a partner of ours called WorldPop, a conflict exposure measure. And so ACLID collects information on discrete conflict events, which we break up into armed violence, organized armed violence, and then demonstrations. So riots, protests, mob violence, etc. If we just look at armed organized violence, or what most people would look at as conflict, we can see that one in six of us live in proximity to these types of events. Now, we took an incredibly conservative.
One in six worldwide.
Yes, one in six.
That's a lot of people.
It is indeed, yes. And that's with our incredibly conservative estimate, which is that we only looked at, for example, did you live close to a battle, an attack on a town, an explosion, etc.? And then we put a boundary of it that is at max 5 kilometers. But we wanted to make sure that we didn't double count people. So this is the most conservative estimate you're going to get. But yes, one in six people.
So one in six people is something like 1.5 billion people,
Yeah, that's right. Living in an area that we would consider to be in active conflict.
Let's segue before we get to talk about some of those places. Let's segue to the conflict index that you and your colleagues have developed and have recently published, which is a nuanced measure of conflict that captures lots of information. Can you talk just for a few moments about the elements of that and what you're trying to measure there, some of which you already just alluded to?
So the index is trying to reiterate something that I've come to believe very strongly, which is that we should not be gauging conflict solely by the number of events or the number of fatalities, especially fatalities, because they tend to be the most biased information that come from reports. But instead, we should think of conflict as existing on a spectrum. And as I mentioned, some level of conflict occurs in almost every country, but conflicts differ quite a bit in their intensity, in their frequency, in their form. And for that reason, we wanted to compare different aggregations of conflict characteristics, not solely event numbers. And so we decided on four key indicators: deadliness, so what proportion of the violence that occurs ends up with fatality; danger to civilians, how much of the conflict that occurs in a year or in a space is directed distinctly towards civilians; how diffuse is this conflict, so how many places in the country has it spread to; and how many armed groups there are. And ACLED is unique in our ability to gauge all four of those in even a single event. And the reason we wanted to really emphasize this is because these characteristics describe quite a bit of what I would refer to as more modern political violence, rather than, as previously noted, the insurgencies or the civil wars, which have largely abated, not totally by any means, but largely decreased. And instead, this kind of political militia behavior, this political disorder has increased, and it catches that. So we found 50 countries where we have the highest level of this conflict. And we break down those countries into extreme, high, or turbulent. And these top 50 countries account for about 97% of all conflict events recorded in the past year. Just scroll down.
That's exactly where I wanted to go. And this is the big reveal. If you look at the list of countries that your index ranks as the most conflicted, that's the wrong way to put it, but let me use that shorthand. The top 10 in the most recent ranking I've seen are Myanmar in order: Myanmar, Syria, Palestine, Mexico, number 4, Nigeria, Brazil, Colombia, Haiti, Yemen. Noticeably, Ukraine ranks 13. Yet if you're a normal person consuming news normally, you would expect top two being Ukraine and Gaza, Palestine, in some order. What's going on here?
Sure. So you're right. I think when it comes to the discrete number of events that might happen per week, per month, Ukraine and Gaza are certainly the highest. But again, because we've decided to make the ranking more nuanced to reflect deadliness, diffusion, fragmentation, and violence against civilians, what you find is many more different options become available. And in fact, in this list, as you noted, Myanmar is the most violent place in the world. And Myanmar does not get a lot of attention for many reasons, but it has literally hundreds of armed groups operating within its border. And they have recently started to consolidate, but mostly they are not consolidated and they are all fighting the junta. And so one of the ways in which we decided to make sure we used ACLED was to highlight the varied ways in which people have to live under extreme violence that is often unseen because it doesn't take on the characteristics that we assume. So for that reason, of course, Ukraine would always be first, but Ukraine is a very kind of standard interstate war. There's two main actors there. In fact, its two-year anniversary that recently passed found that the actual geographic distribution of Ukraine has not moved almost at all in the time since it really began. So it was never going to fare highly on those two factors that we wanted to prioritize, although it does, of course, in both. It's the highest in fatalities, so the deadliness measure I mentioned before, And it actually has a lower rate of violence against civilians than you might think. In fact, last year, in the whole year, the rate of violence against Ukrainian civilians decreased by 70%, despite events going up.
Oh, I talked to journalists who are working in Ukraine, and they will talk about a delightful afternoon in Kyiv at a coffee shop where you could be anywhere in Europe. And not that far away if they're on the front line. It really is quite nasty. It is World War I, Paris versus the trenches.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I mean, I remember I would go to the Congo and you would often find people, you know, not enjoying themselves, but certainly not in an active war zone when you were speaking with them. And I think it reflects this, which is that civil wars typically affect about 15% of a territory, which means that 85% of the territory is not affected. And the attitudes and also the governance that's happening in that 85 versus that 15% tend to be completely different. So it's often wrong maybe to call a country at war. What you often find is that there's a very distinct population that is repeatedly assaulted.
And you've also made the point in some of your work that some countries are plagued with multiple problems. You can have more than one, both kind of conflict and more than one, different parts of the countries impacted by different kinds of actors, et cetera. So it's not that there's double counting. It's rather that some countries really are plagued.
Yeah, that's a perfect way of putting it. So that was actually the motivation for ACLED in the very beginning. I was going to do a PhD on how there seemed to be several conflicts in many countries that almost had nothing to do with each other. They had very limited rates of both spatial and also kind of political agenda overlap. And so there wasn't a huge amount of attention towards these almost contradictions in how people understood conflict. Not only was it geographically clustered, but the clusters could be multiple and distinct. And so in creating ACLED, I was able to think a little bit more about that process. And one of the things that came out of it, which I think might be relevant for this discussion, is that we tend to think of conflict as a reaction to poverty or a reaction to bad governance. But in fact, the form it takes is a reaction to how its relationship to the government has been kind of maturing in a particular area. Because conflict is a contest for power. It is not about a political vacuum. It's not about poverty. It's very rarely about exclusion. It is an active fight for authority. And those who are most likely to engage in that fight are already in authority or have some sort of links or close ties to authority. It is not the, what's the famous phrase, the modality of the weak or a tool of the weak in any way, shape, or form. It is a contest for power, often amongst the powerful.
So the assumed correlation between more conflict, less economic development, more conflict, less freedom are not necessarily accurate.
No, not at all. And in fact, that relationship has become weaker and weaker as we go forward. In fact, the index, one of the interesting conclusions of the index is that where we're seeing the most growth in conflict events, where we're seeing the most growth in conflict more and conflict exposure, the number of people exposed to conflict, is in middle and high income countries and in countries that have adopted some, if not many, democratic institutions. So we need to decouple this interpretation of development or underdevelopment as a precursor to conflict, because it certainly isn't. That's not to say that there isn't plenty of conflict in lower income countries. There is, but it's not related to poverty. Poverty is an issue that we need to tackle because of how important it is for people to lead dignified lives, that they are not dependent on the state or international institutions. But these are not the people who become violent.
This is going to be a sort of crude way to put what I think you just said. You don't fight over nothing. You fight over something.
Yeah. And especially, you know, there's a lot of kind of presumed associations between conflict and food insecurity, or conflict and famine. And certainly conflicts can exacerbate food insecurity. There's no question about that. But food insecurity does not cause conflict. The hungry do not fight. And so this impression that we had, especially strongly when the Arab Spring was happening, that, you know, problems for over bread prices were going to lead to a mass increase in violence, that really got that relationship the wrong way around. And I worry that people assume that a lack of economic resources makes communities violent, and it does not.
Oh, I think the problem is that people don't think about and certainly don't understand power. Yeah. You already made that point. It's about power.
It's entirely about power.
Let's go back to Mexico for a moment, because number four on this hit parade is not a place you want to be. That's important to the Mexicans, but interested to the Americans as well, of course. Interestingly, of the top 10 countries in your risk index, four of them are in Latin America, which is not a place we tend to think of as violent, because we don't have the nuanced thinking about violence that you're bringing to this discussion. But Mexico specifically, what's going on?
So that's a really great question. Mexico ranks number one in our list for the proportion of violence that's directed towards civilians. Now, that's very important because of the nature of Mexican violence. It's not about a contest to overtake the state. It is driven largely by competing cartels, these cartels have decided to overtake both public and political space with their demands for the control of territory, the control of authority, and the control of populations. And so in many ways, they look very similar to a rebel group, but their engagement with each other is often extremely violent, meaning that they actually take on a lot of characteristics of militia. But this is all for an economic motive, or rather it is rooted in an economic motive. But its effects on the political population, or rather the political environment in Mexico and the civilians in Mexico, is one of a warlike outcome. And we have ignored some aspects of the Mexican context, and I would argue Brazil and now post-war Colombia, for the exact same reason. It doesn't look like we think conflict should look. The agenda is not the same as we would ascribe to Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And so we don't ascribe it the same sort of political heft or even the political agenda. And I think that's wrong.
To the point, my friends who think about this issue in Mexico would argue that there are at least seven of the 31 states where government writ does not particularly extend, certainly not at night and not during many daytimes. If you've already lost control of seven states out of 31, and those are important border states by definition almost, you have a serious problem.
Oh, no question. There's a really wonderful journalist named Ion Grillo, and he recently did a map of Mexican cartel control. And it's shocking about the level of detail that Mexicans have to know about and have to live with, which is that their territories, their states are not being controlled by the administration. And what's more, of course, there's an election later this year in Mexico. We would expect maybe 200 candidates or sitting administrators to be either assassinated or have attempted assassinations against them, largely by these groups, because the actions are political. You know, who controls political power and who owns those people is really what's being contested over in Mexico.
And that kind of phenomenon where these groups, whether the cartels, other kinds of groups, effectively take political power is one of the obvious consequences of how you're thinking about violence more broadly, which is why so many Latin American countries are on those lists, why many African countries are on that list, which aren't typically places we think of. We think of them as violent, but we don't think of them as conflicted, which is a funny distinction.
Yeah, I worry that the cartel model is the growth is the area of growth within conflict. And what I mean by that is looking at conflict a bit like a market, where you have the market itself is about hiring staffing, the violent labor market. Then you have the business of conflict, and that's people who will create the militia and seek clients. And then the clients are political elites who invest in conflict. And so looking at it through this type of, like I said, this kind of market model, I think will help us explain conflicts that are currently occurring, for example, in Nigeria and certainly in Mexico, many of the Latin American states, as you mentioned. But I worry increasingly this will become an incredibly feasible model for many countries. So this is facilitated by the number of armed groups that I mentioned have really exploded in the last few years.
I would add, for example, the Netherlands to that list, where we see that kind of conflict already evident and growing rapidly. It's becoming dangerous.
That's interesting. That could feasibly be another element of the market model, which is you have the market, the business, the conflict investments, and then you have the conflict network, which is where these things are linked in order to support each other across very large amounts of space.
A world under stress like ours needs better leaders in every discipline and in every country. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If you know someone like that in your company, in your university, in your community, anywhere, please nominate her or him for the Tilburg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize. Nominations will open on March 15th. For more info, check out tilburgprize.org. Let's add one more dimension, which is climate change. You've done some work recently. You co-authored an article in Lancet's Planetary Health publication that talked about households facing climate hazards are more likely to be in conflict places than in peaceful places.
It was designed to throw a lot of doubt on this climate security model that we see emerging, especially in the West and being applied to countries in Africa and Asia. And my issue with it is this, which is that conflict is about power, as we recently discussed. And I have never seen a plausible explanation linking power dimensions to the changes that climate change is bringing to all of these countries. Climate change, to me, is a co-occurring risk, which means that it's not affecting or causing the conflict. But because they co-occur, any sort of program to deal with conflict needs to understand but not try to deal with the conflict. And any program to deal with conflict has to be aware of these, you know, major changes that climate change is bringing. But increasingly, what people try to do is deal with the climate by politically engineering a conflict solution. And unfortunately, what I think ends up happening most of all is that neither are successful.
And resources are wasted. Climate mitigation doesn't occur. Climate adaptation doesn't occur, nor does conflict mitigation occur.
That's right. And I think that part of it is that people treat conflict as very homogenous. And as we've been discussing, it's really not, right? So to bring up Somalia again, because I think it's a really useful case. If we understood the dimensions of conflict more, we would look at Somalia and think of it as a very high intensity conflict, but actually quite stable, quite consistent. It's not at all volatile in the way that you might see Ethiopia as not as violent in terms of numbers anymore after the northern conflict has ceased, but incredibly volatile as to where and whom is likely to engage in violence. And in both of those countries, you can have climate change adaptation solutions, but they need to be shifted to appreciate or to take into account the nature of the violence.
We've been talking about, if you will, the what's happening. I want to be unfair and ask the why. The obvious question is, if we do live clearly in this era of rising conflict, measured in all the ways that you've described it, both in terms of number of events, geography of events, most importantly, impact on people. Again, I go back to something you said at the start, 1 in 6 people worldwide are impacted in the way that you define it. Why do you think all this is happening?
That's a great question. And it's tricky to answer in part because I believe that the forms of conflict can tell us a lot more about why we're seeing this increase. So we're seeing an increase because the form of conflict has become far more militia-based, far more localized, more prolific. And I think it's become more prolific because of this contest for power that I mentioned earlier. Now, this is also related to something that I also consider to be incredibly important, which is political order is undervalued. It's underrated as an incredibly important way in which no state can succeed without having first a level of political order, then the ability to change or to the capacity to change, the capacity to deliver services. And then on top of that, be inclusive of all groups within that country and be representative. We have tended in the last 20 years to prioritize the first, which is to be representative, and maybe not so much the capabilities and certainly not the political order. I think it's because in the West, we have an idea that political order comes from representation, you know, and democratic representation at that. And that is true, that it does facilitate a particular form of order because of widespread benefits. But in other countries and in other contexts where you've had a proliferation of state, let's say, appointments and a proliferation of state representation, but without political order, I think that quite a lot of politics or quite a lot of power competition has been created from this process. And the violence is an incredibly effective way to compete in a political arena. And so many, especially political elites in government or those wanting to get into governments, have invested, as I mentioned before, in this form in order to do so. And it's been met with a very tepid response from their own governments. In fact, one of the kind of perverse beauties of having political militias or political disorder, as I've mentioned, being the most prolific form of violence, is that often the government isn't all that concerned because the violence isn't against the government. It's against each other and it's against civilians. And they're willing to take quite a high level of conflict in their country in order to preserve the power hierarchy as they are.
Oh, you just described Mexico. You just described Mexico. The government tolerates the violence because it's not aimed at the government in some ways.
That's a great point. I mean, like I'm saying, I'm worried that Mexico represents the
future, you
know, the near real-time future. And conflicts such as that in, for example, Ethiopia are a little bit now representing kind of the past.
Let me ask about technology, because it occurs to me that technology also facilitates more conflict, both in terms of social media, which facilitates communication in really broadly through the society, but also the democratization of war making, drones, other kinds of weaponry, which is now ubiquitously available. It's not just, are the Americans exporting too many guns? It's everything can be weaponized.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started out, the biggest issue was the proliferation of small arms. And that now has been taken over by an even more deadly form, of course, of technology, which is the drone. I mean, of course, in most of the conflicts that I see, we're still using, you know, more typical weapons. But certainly Ukraine, but also some of the, let's say, I don't want to call them client states, but some of the more recent conflicts we've seen support from places like Iran or Turkey or UAE through these more sophisticated weapon systems. And countries are more than happy to take them on. So I think that what we will have is more violence rather than a tremendous change in the violence that is occurring. And it would be very worrying to think that we could have a spread of that violence. I don't know if that will be the result, but I certainly know that our casualties, our fatalities will go up.
Let me end with a question about the United States. In past iterations of your index, you identified the U.S. as a turbulent country. It was on that list of 50. It's not on the list of 50 at the moment. I would hope that's a good sign, but I worry that we're just a pause between two periods. How do you think about the United States from the point of view of conflict?
That's a great question. So you're right. In fact, we started or restarted the U.S. Crisis Monitor yesterday, and we had started that in the last election, 2020. And we found, of course, not only were there a tremendous number of demonstrations, but also quite a high rate of far-right militia behavior. Now, since January 6, 2021, militia behavior has almost completely tanked in the U.S. So there's a very, very low rate of it at the moment. And demonstrations have also gone down, especially after the really, really strong social justice movement lost a little bit of its steam. But I would hasten to add that what worries me the most about the U.S. during this particular cycle is not that it will be a repeat of 2020, because I do think those circumstances were unique. And I don't think that we should see a proliferation of militia activity, because I think that the Biden administration and, of course, just the general public security institutions in the states have been extremely good at mitigating that threat. What worries me is that when I investigated yesterday, in fact, the types of protests and riots and militia behavior that is occurring in some of the five most important swing states, they were all against the current administration, and they were all quite varied. So in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan, you had pro-Gaza protests that were becoming anti-Biden protests. In Wisconsin, you had protests around abortion. And of course, in both Georgia and Arizona, you have a pretty consistent rate of protest around domestic policy, broadly defined. The states with the highest rate of militia activity are Arizona, California, Texas, Tennessee, and Ohio. So, you know, Arizona and Ohio are very important areas within the U.S. political scene at the moment. And it worries me that this is also the region where you're seeing the most contestation.
So turbulence may be coming back.
I think that whereas I do not believe it will be a repeat of 2020 and the disorder that the U.S. saw then, I don't think that we're going to make it out of this election entirely unscathed.
I'm not sure if that makes you an optimist or a pessimist or both at the same time, but I certainly hope you're right that it looks better than it did a year ago.
Yeah, and I think people forget about that. I mean, the misinformation goes in two directions. You know, it can incite a lot of bad behavior, but it can also, to use a word, awfulize what is kind of typical behavior during an election.
I love that word. I'll try to use it in a headline sometime. Awfulize.
Yeah, it's. I've seen a lot of awfulizing without really the evidence to suggest it's the right thing to do.
Thank you very much for this conversation. I've learned a lot. I think everybody who's listening will learn a lot. And I very much appreciate, as an analyst, the work you're doing, because I found it brings nuance to my work. So please keep on building it.
Well, you're very kind. And this was a real delightful way to spend the afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.